Nothing's certain in politics, but professionals know one thing. Subscribing to the Cook Political Report is the right decision in every election cycle.
For more than four decades, the Cook Political Report has been providing political professionals with the right analysis to help them invest political capital with confidence.
A deep knowledge of the past, combined with a meticulous, unbiased analysis of the present, produces the most accurate predictions of the future, time and time again.
Because it's all backed by data from every input that decides elections for president, Congress, and governorships.
Subscribers to the Cook Political Report get the clarity they need through smart analysis that you won't get anywhere else.
Like the very latest outlook for every race and access to our analysts. Amy Walter, David Wasserman, Carrie Dan, Jessica Taylor, Aaron Covey, and Matthew Klein.
The Cook Political Report offers
the right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
For getting it right.
Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe.
Hello and welcome to The Odd Years. I'm Amy Walter. We're about 8 months into Donald Trump's second term, a victory driven in large part due to voter frustration with the economy and their belief that he would help get inflation down. So, what does the economic picture look like today? That's not as easy a question to answer as you think it should be. Stock market is at record highs, but consumers remain pessimistic about inflation. The tariffs implemented by the Trump administration haven't caused the kinds of economic damage many economists predicted they would. Yet it's also clear that tariffs are impacting economic decision-making in ways that aren't altogether obvious. And then there's AI. If you work for or invested in a company making AI, you're doing great. But what about those folks, especially new graduates entering the workforce, who are being displaced by the new technology? Thankfully, I found someone to help us better understand this moment. Heather Long is chief economist at Navy Federal Credit Union and a contributing columnist for The Washington Post. I turned to Heather a lot when she served as the economic correspondent for The Washington Post from 2017 to 2025. She's not only super smart, but she can make very confusing and complicated subjects like this one understandable and approachable. We recorded this conversation on Wednesday, September 24th. Heather Long, thank you so much for joining me. I've really been looking forward to this conversation.
Well, thanks for having me on, Amy.
So I want to start with something you wrote in a recent column, kind of explaining where we are in this economy. And you said the economy is increasingly dependent on a small sliver of superstar companies and wealthy consumers to stay afloat. Can you help us understand what that means?
Yes, it's a really confusing time for the economy, but the way that I make sense of it is I call it a K-shape economy. And what I mean by that is there's a handful of people and companies at the top, superstars, if you will, that are living a pretty great life. You know, the stock market is at record highs. This AI boom is going on, and there's more spending on AI investments right now by businesses than there is consumption in the economy, which is just mind-boggling.
Right. I mean, have we ever seen anything like that in sort of the recent era? And I'm thinking about when we talked about the internet boom of the early 2000s and the bubble there. You're saying this is even bigger than anything we saw at that time.
In some ways, yes, yeah. Particularly the way that it's outpacing, dwarfing everything else in the economy right now. And so if you're involved in one of those superstar companies, you know, pick your favorite, Oracle, Amazon, Microsoft, NVIDIA, then this feels great. It's a great time. Or if you're somebody who's in the number in my head really is $175,000 or more, and we can debate, you know, New York City, I know that doesn't go as far, but we see it in our own data at Navy Federal Credit Union, as well as in the national data, that the top 20%, if you will, of fairly well-off families who are earning $175,000 or above, they're still spending. They're still revenge spending, whatever you want to call it, you know, throwing big weddings, big birthday parties, going on lavish vacations, spending way above inflation growth. And it's totally different for the bottom 80%. It's really hesitant. You know, people can generally pay their bills, but there's nothing extra left right now. They're at their max and their spending is barely keeping pace with inflation. They're worried about losing their jobs in this frozen job market. Some might even call it a job recession that we're in right now. And they're worried about high prices. And we can see it in our own data. You know, people are shifting from spending at Target to going to Walmart. You know, Walmart's favorite consumer right now earns $100,000 a year. Right. Or more.
Right.
Because those people are trying to stretch every dollar. You know, I wouldn't consider $100,000 to be poor. You know, that's pretty middle class.
Exactly. Right. When we're talking about who's trying to stretch their dollars, you could argue, you know, 80% is not exactly a small percent of the American public. So is this stretching, Heather, this feeling of being under pressure and clearly their incomes are not keeping pace with the cost of stuff. How much of that is related to what we saw between the end of COVID and the high rate of inflation and its after effects versus this concern about tariffs or the real impact that tariffs are having on everyday prices?
Yeah, that's a great question. Let me try to put some numbers on it.
Yeah.
The bulk of it, let's say 90%, and it could be 95 or 85, but let's say around 90% was what has come in the past 4 years or so from that big inflation surge in summer of 2022 and 2023. So for most middle-class families, when they're talking about my housing, my car ownership, my electric bill, and my utilities are up, you know, hugely, in many cases, double even the rate of overall inflation. So overall inflation, you know, maybe up 24-25% since 2020. You know, many of these areas are up even more than that in the past 5 years. So that's really the bulk of the pain that's coming in the budget. But the fear is, oh my gosh, is it coming back again? You know, now with the tariffs coming through, people starting to notice. I mean, if you've been looking for furniture lately or electronic goods, you've started to notice it. I know I have a young child who, and so they grow all the time, and I've been buying a lot of kids' shoes.
Right.
And even though shoes for kids are not hugely expensive, I buy them at Walmart. You know, I noticed that the same pair of shoes that I bought in the spring for $10 is now $14. You know, so again, did that totally break my budget? No, but people are starting to see it. And I think the fears are heightened because of the trauma we all just lived through.
And so you've talked about this term, again, one of your columns about stagflation, but you've called it sort of stagflation light is what we may be facing. And that would be this inflation pressure that you just highlighted, but also an economy that isn't growing. And then doesn't that also come with higher unemployment? Like, tell us how likely it is that in the next year or so, what we may be facing isn't just a frustration with prices, but people actually losing their jobs on top of this.
Yeah, that's one of my biggest fears.
Yeah.
You know, I've been calling the job market frozen for 8 or 9 months now. You know, it used to be frozen for the tech sector, and then it was professional and business services, or everything from accounting and architects to salespeople. But what we've seen in the last few months, since the summer really, is many industries are actually starting to shed jobs. And it's both a white collar and a blue collar jobs recession. You know, it's those white collar ones we were already worried about, but also now manufacturing, mining, construction even are all net negative. Really, the only industry adding jobs right now is healthcare and maybe AI, but AI is not doing a ton of hiring. It's just, you know, makes a lot of headlines. And so if you don't work in healthcare, good luck. Good luck finding a job. And the problem with the tariffs that are really starting to come through now is somebody has to eat those costs, right? And if it's not, it's either going to be passed through to the consumer and it's going to hurt the budgets of the consumers even more in the coming months, or the companies are going to continue to try to eat these costs and they're not charitable organizations. And so you're starting to see a lot of CEOs talk about cost cutting, which is the business speak for cutting headcount. You know, we'll just reduce the size of our headcount to try to contain the costs for a while. And so either way, it's a middle class squeeze.
So this is then what I guess I don't understand about all of this, Heather, is that given all of these pressures, the data suggests that the economy is doing okay. And at the very beginning, you pointed out that it's because of the spending of higher income folks and folks invested in AI. But at some point, is that enough, right? At some point, do we hit a place where just that spending by the top 20% and by Oracle isn't enough to make up for what headwinds are facing 80% of people in this country?
It definitely could happen. And having an economy that is so reliant on the rich and on these superstar firms, that's dangerous too. I mean, look, if there's a stock market correction, that's also going to cause even the wealthy people to pull back on their spending. And that could cause a downturn or a recession. So I think you're right. This really heightens the risks for the economy to be standing on so few legs right now, if you will. And then on top of that, there's all the societal problems of, as the middle class and majority of America is feeling that squeeze. You know, obviously, we're already starting to see it. At the moment, people are substituting. In economics, we talk about substituting. You know, instead of shopping at the Target, they are shopping at Walmart and Costco and these budget places. But at some point, if the cost pressures continue to rise, or certainly if people continue to lose jobs, yeah, they're going to stop spending, and that could also trigger a downturn effect. So another trend that we're seeing at Navy Federal Credit Union, you can kind of see it in the national data, but I'm watching closely, is what I call job downgrading. And so people have jobs, but they'll increasingly say, my hours are being cut. And for a lot of working class people, overtime is where they really make their money. You know, when they get paid time and a half, whether they're a childcare worker, whether they're in a warehouse worker, you know, even in the medical field, it's those overtime hours where they're really able to do well for themselves. And we're just hearing more and more stories, and you can see it in the data that the average work week, average hours people are at work has been coming down. And so, you know, that's what's so weird is even if the unemployment rate still looks pretty low at 4.3%, there's just huge anxiety and pain right now that's happening right under the surface.
Right. That's a very good point. If we can talk about tariffs for a minute, if you listen to folks who are either supportive of what the Trump administration is doing or who are saying, you know, I am open-minded about tariffs, they would say, well, you know, businesses are pretty creative. And yes, some of it is, as you said, Heather, that they've been eating some of that cost, or they went out and they basically bought a bunch of stuff before the tariffs kicked in. And so they haven't had to pay those tariffs yet. And that ultimately businesses will figure this out, right? That between the growth of AI, which could mean job loss, so we'll get to that in a minute. But the growth of AI and, you know, sort of a more agile business thinking, maybe these tariffs don't bite as hard as what the traditional economic models would tell us.
Look, one of the White House's best arguments is A, to give it time,
yeah,
that it takes time for this, they're trying to make big changes in the economy. And it, and the second one is what you're saying, that not all of this is going to be passed along to the consumer. And so far, they've been correct.
Yeah.
You know, this certainly doesn't. There's some great work by the Harvard Pricing Lab, Albert Cavallo there, professor, and he's really famous for having lived in Argentina and developed the tracking system for Argentine inflation. And he's now doing it for the U.S. and the tariffs. And he always makes a good point to me that it often does come through bit by bit by bit, sort of the boiling frog metaphor with inflation and with tariff impacts. So, you know, I think many people, I would probably put myself in this category in the spring, were a bit breathless and saying like, oh, it's all going to hit the consumer right away. But, you know, it is inching up and inching up. So let me flip that another way. I keep making the argument that I think the Federal Reserve is right to cut the interest rates because I don't see an inflation crisis. And the reason I don't see an inflation crisis isn't because companies are brilliant or, you know, they're finding all these new ways. It's the middle class squeeze. The middle class cannot absorb so many higher costs. And they're pushing back this time, which is very different than 2022 when people were flush with cash across the income spectrum. They had the stimulus payments. They had all that savings from not spending during the COVID lockdowns. And so this time around, you see it and brands can't, you know, they can't just pass it all on to consumers. But that doesn't mean it's not it's not hurting the economy somewhere.
That's right. That's a really great point. I also want to, As we're talking about numbers, I want to ask you something as an economist who relies on government data. And as we're seeing the Trump administration put pressure on the Fed, obviously fire the BLS director, raise questions about the credibility as they were firing the BLS director, saying the credibility of these surveys is already problematic, right? That there aren't enough respondents, that they're using old modeling techniques, that basically this data is not a good assessment, it's not a correct assessment of the U.S. economy. And so I'd love to just sort of get an economist's take on how, first of all, how you use government data and how that informs your thesis and how you are looking at the economy, and then how these changes that the Trump administration is bringing could impact that.
Yes. Okay. I think there's two kind of key points to keep in mind for most people. Number one is, look, private sector data, including our own, you know, we have 15 million accounts in Navy Federal Credit Union. We have a pretty good idea of if those people are still employed and still getting their direct deposits or not and what they're spending on. But that's only 15 million people out of a nation of 330 million, you know, 130 million households. And so there is, people sometimes say, well, private sector data could replace. It cannot replace government data in a country this large and this dynamic, yeah, you know, and this diverse across so many different places. And that's why you really need good government data. It's why so many decisions, you know, not just Wall Street decisions, but good policy decisions, good business investment decisions are largely based off government data. And so that's why you hear such a wide range, you know, not just nerdy data people like me, but even a lot of business people coming out and saying, or even healthcare people, like, no, don't destroy government data. We need this to make smart decisions for our nation. Now, that said, we all want to get better, right? We all want to get better. And as you pointed out, the survey response rates for a lot of these government data have been going down, particularly on the first time people are asked to respond. Like, I don't always respond to everything in my email inbox right away or on time. You need a little prodding sometimes. The good news is by the time that the government prods people for the third time, they tend to respond. It's just that process.
Did they just say upping this? Is that what
yeah.
they do?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, but at the, you know, and so the response rates are pretty good, but it takes 3 months to do that. So the argument, you know, is kind of how can we get people to respond faster, respond more quickly? I think that's a good conversation to be having. You know, same thing with, there's a lot have been made of the big job revision that came out, right, and this idea that suddenly we have almost a million fewer jobs than we thought between April 2024 and March 2025. That's a big number. All right. I don't think we should totally, you know, just say that's business as usual. Now, what was going on there is very simple to explain. It's something called the birth-death model. I don't mean birth-death of humans. I mean birth-death of businesses. So there's been this huge explosion of startups since the pandemic. A lot of people founding their own companies, which is awesome. But the BLS basically thought it was going to be a lot more bakeries and restaurants that were being started up, and that those require a lot of staff, right? You got to hire a lot of people to help serve and help bake your goods and da-da-da-da. In reality, it turned out to be the influencer economy. It was a lot of people running their own one-person influencer brands, or, you know, consulting firms, or these types of things where they didn't hire other people, or they hired only one other person. And so they miscalculated. They overestimated how many people were being hired at these new companies, if that makes sense.
It makes total sense.
And so, you know, they made a mistake and they need to fix that model. But it's not like it was some nefarious, cataclysmic mistake, you know, that you kind of know why they did it. And they're very transparent about it. And so I think I sit here and say, look, we need to make the data better and find methods to make it better. But, you know, firing the BLS commissioner and maybe putting somebody in there who tends to be very political, that doesn't seem to be the best way to solve those problems that we were just talking about.
That's
right. So that's where, you know, I think the middle of the road response is.
Is probably the best. We'll be back with Heather Long. If you want to stay up to date on all redistricting news, check out our new redistricting tracker. We'll be continually updating it as we get news of midterm redistricting in states. The CPR redistricting tracker is only available to Cook Political Report subscribers, so consider subscribing today. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. The offer is available only to new subscribers. The other thing I wanted to get you to weigh in on is this very interesting dynamic we're seeing in the White House with the president now, specifically with this Intel deal, right? Basically, the government saying, hey, we'll give you your $9 billion. You just give the U.S. a 10% stake in your company. Now, I guess I have multiple layers of questions here. So we'll start with the first, which is just on a very basic level. What is the impact of a U.S. government having a stake, and maybe a permanent stake, in a company?
You're right. The interesting part is it going to be a permanent stake?
Yeah.
You know, we have done this at times. The Intel, to me, is a little bit different of a question than what the government has done, the Trump administration, with Nippon Steel and U.S. Steel, the Japan deal, or with NVIDIA when they are asking for basically a cut for the government of the sales of chips to China. You know, look, the reality is Intel had made a lot of bad business decisions. They basically missed the smartphone boom, and they were, you know, they're kind of like General Motors was when the government bailed them out in the financial crisis. Okay, so, you know, did we want to keep this company or not? And obviously, we're making this bipartisan strategic investment in the semiconductor space, which I think is smart. And we didn't want to see Intel fail. You know, the Biden administration was going to give them billions of dollars to try to revive themselves, but their business plan was not working very well, and they kind of needed to come and get another handout. That's sort of what happened here, which is very different than some of the other stakes the White House is trying to take in other companies. So I don't know. Was it the worst thing as a U.S. taxpayer to say, okay, Intel, we're going to give you this huge infusion of cash, but if your stock suddenly takes off, you know, we want a little bit of the reward as the taxpayer. So I don't know. The Intel one, I actually don't think was horrible. I think when you put it in the context of all of these other interventions in the private sector, that's where it becomes this troubling pattern of, you know, are we doing capitalism anymore around here or not?
Are we doing state-sponsored capitalism? And that is the question I really wanted to get to, because it's clear that whether it is the president or those in his administration, they have floated the idea of doing this with other industries, right? We spend a lot of money on defense. Why should defense contractors not have to give some of that, their earnings, back to the taxpayers who funded this? Beyond the fact that this really messes with our concept of what Republicans and Democrats stand for, right? Watching Bernie Sanders support many of the things that Trump is suggesting while conservative economists are losing their minds. Do we think that this is maybe the start of something? We're talking a lot about, on both sides, Democrat and Republican, a sort of populist revolution, right? A deepening frustration among Americans about corporations, the amount of money they make, and that while this slides into something that the U.S., again, traditionally would not be doing, which is basically state-sponsored capitalism, that this may become something that both Democratic and Republican presidents do to respond to this populist moment.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of thinking about it. I think what's interesting to me is trying to put it in the broader context of all the policies that are going on right now. And this is probably one of the few policies that is their attempt to, you know, do a Robin Hood, to take from the superstars and attempt and give to the populace. Most of the other policies we've been talking about, like tariffs, are a tax on everybody, you know, at the end of the day. And that's arguably hurting a lot of middle class and lower income Americans and smaller firms. You know, smaller firms didn't have the huge warehouse to store the inventory and bring it in ahead of the tariffs. Or with the, you know, H-1B visa, this idea we could charge $100,000 for special types of immigrants. You know, again, that's hurts everyone, but it tends to be much more onerous for smaller businesses than it does for large.
Oh, that's so interesting, Heather, because I saw that initially as something. I was about to throw the H-1B visa as a Robin Hood kind of thing. If you look at, all right, who's using these H-1B visas? It's Amazon, it's Meta. Right. So make them pay for this. But your point is actually it's the smaller startups that need these workers and they can't afford to do it. And it's so it only makes Meta and Google bigger and more powerful.
It could potentially, you know, you're right. You can argue that one a little bit both ways in terms of what the Robin Hood effect is there. Again, I'm not defending. I think it's really troubling to see going down this route of getting more and more involved in business and taking these stakes. And, you know, look, the bottom line is, and Argentina is a good example, it doesn't end well. You know, it starts out sounding like a great policy. We're doing this to help the people and help the taxpayers. But at the end of the day, unfortunately, the track record around the world is not a good one, that it unfortunately usually ends with more poverty, fewer jobs, and less innovation. And I think everyone can agree we're in an innovation race, particularly with the Chinese right now, and we don't want to be shooting ourselves in the foot in this innovation race.
Let's then shift to that innovation race and AI. There's a lot of opinion about AI right now that's floating out there. And I'd love for you to sort of give your perspective on AI's impact today on a couple of things. The first is the job market. There is this, again, perception that if you are new to the job market, let's say you're a recent college graduate, that you're going to have a very hard time getting into entry-level jobs because AI is replacing those entry-level jobs. And so for younger folks, it's just one more barrier to get into the market. And the second is this idea that by the time we get this is moving so rapidly that by the time we hit 2028, the conversation that politicians are going to be having about AI will be on the potentially devastating impact it's having on employment across all sectors, and that there's not a fulsome conversation in the political space by leadership to think about what a policy answer to that would be. So I'd love to get any of your insights on those.
Yeah, I know. I agree with you a lot on what you were just saying. So look, let me say today, you're right. Let's separate today from 2028.
Yeah.
Today, AI gets way too much credit for taking jobs. And no, a business leader said something to me just a week or two ago that really stuck with me. He was like, AI is the greatest fig leaf, you know, to be able, I can lay people off and blame it on AI and not actually have to give a real explanation. And I think that's right. When people call me and say, what's going on for young people? I say, look, it's the same thing that's going on for why the Black unemployment rate has shot up. You know, the reality is there's three factors going on. Number one is the uncertainty, the tariff factor. And in any time we see downturns or the beginning of downturns, the Black unemployment rate and the young people unemployment rate immediately spike up first, you know, the economic canary in the coal mine situation. The second factor that's going on is the reality that a lot of companies overhired during the Great Resignation era. You know, they were scared that they weren't going to get enough employees. And it was like a, you know, grab as many as you can kind of game, like that hippo game where you're trying to grab so many marbles. It was kind of like that in the labor market in 2022 and 2023. And a lot of companies are trying to right size right now. And so that factor is also going on. The third factor is AI. And I think you can look at these three factors and we can all rate them differently. I personally say like 70% of what's going on in the labor market now is the tariff uncertainty. Maybe 20% is the right sizing and 10% is the AI. Okay. And that 10% is highly in coding.
Yeah.
And as opposed to across many fields. In terms of tomorrow, I think you're 100% right. The reason that so many of these AI executives, particularly Anthropic, Dario, Amade, are out there saying, like, there could be mass layoffs is to try to shake Washington into action. This is not a hard problem to solve. And what I mean by that is we know our unemployment insurance system is really poor and needs to be better. And we can do things like if the unemployment rate hits, I don't know, 8%, we could have a lot more interventions than if it hits 5. You know, same thing with we know America can get better at job training. I'm a huge proponent of people love apprenticeships, earn while you learn to retrain. The good news is we doubled our amount of apprenticeships in the past 10 years. The bad news is we only do, you know, fewer than a million of these a year. We should be doing like 3, 4, 5 million. It's not that expensive to do these types of retraining and apprenticeship programs. And so these types of things, you know, there's bipartisan agreement on, but we're not doing them. And that's what's really, you know, makes me pull my hair out. Like, we have the solutions. Let's get them in place. And you can put triggers in. We don't know. In 2028, could it be mass unemployment or could it still be a little bit of a trickle? We don't know, but you can design policy to say, look, if the unemployment rate gets to 7 or 8%, we're going to have a lot more aggressive intervention than if we're sitting here in a 4 to 5% unemployment rate.
Right, right. Yeah, the one final thing to weigh in on, Washington is now on the precipice of potential government shutdown. It feels more and more likely every day, and this government shutdown may extend for a good amount of time. So what do government shutdowns mean for the economy?
This is always, you can hear my deep sigh. economists always get asked this. The sad truth is for the economy, it's kind of a blip, right? Because usually, you know, eventually the government will reopen and a lot of that money that they would have sent out, let's say October 5th, you know, will get sent out November 5th. Now, in the meantime, there's, you know, the human impacts. Obviously, federal workforce has been through a lot in the last year, and this is even more demoralizing and harmful for people who aren't getting paid during that time period or for parks that are closed and not getting the fall foliage revenue or whatnot. But the bigger one is really what I call, honestly, the best TikTok I ever did was, you want to know the Trump economy? Pay attention to the bond market, which I never thought I would say in a million years, the boring bond market. But bonds are not boring anymore. Bonds and bond investors are basically forcing government leaders around the world to get in line or get out. We obviously saw it dramatically in the United Kingdom. You know, the bond market basically got their prime minister fired. But, you know, it could happen here, too. And that's that loss of if we get to a point where bond investors just look at yet another shutdown and just, you know, say, this is crazy, and you can't get your act together, you can't pass a budget, you're just spending more money. You know, it's that erosion of confidence, and we don't know at what point that could really start to spiral in the market.
Right. I think it was James Carville who said during the Clinton administration that he used to wish that when he was a kid, he would come back in a second life as, you know, Major League Baseball player, like be the coolest thing on earth. And now he said, actually, I want to come back as the bond market, because that is the most powerful thing on earth
right now. Right now, it sure feels
that way. The bond market is not something that you're taught as a kid of having tremendous influence, right? Everybody wants to be, if I want to have tremendous influence, I want to be Jeff Bezos. So it's like, actually, he doesn't have as much influence on the direction of the economy as the bond market does. And
or even on politics, which is crazy.
Right. Or even on politics, right?
So we're talking about it right now. So
go hug a bond trader is what you're saying.
Well, yeah, try to buy them off, maybe. But yeah.
Well, that is Heather, in just a very short amount of time, you helped make a whole lot of sense about an economy that feels very complicated. It is very complicated, but you helped to cut through a lot of it. And I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me, Amy. Let's keep buying bonds.
Oh. Yeah, there we go.
No, kidding. Not official
Not
advice.
Not official endorsement. Not official endorsement. Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you like what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You're our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kahn.